This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the interview Terry recorded earlier this month with Larry Wilmore, the host of Comedy Central's The Nightly Show, the new program that follows The Daily Show in the 11:30 spot vacated by Stephen Colbert. Wilmore used to be The Daily Show's senior black correspondent. Jon Stewart's an executive producer of the new show and chose Wilmore to take over Colbert's time slot. The Nightly Show often starts with an opening monologue by Wilmore. The centerpiece is a discussion moderated by Wilmore on a social, cultural, or political issue. The panels include politicians, journalists, actors, musicians, and comics. Wilmore's worked in TV a long time. He wrote for In Living Color, created The Bernie Mac Show, co-created the animated series The PJs with Eddie Murphy, was a consulting producer for The Office, and was the showrunner for the new sitcom Black-ish. Here's how he started the first episode of The Nightly Show on January 19th, Martin Luther King Day.
Tonight, Lee, the Oscar nominations are out, and they're so white, a grand jury has decided not to indict them. Oprah marched on Selma this weekend. She has a dream that Selma shall overcome the wedding ringer at the box office. Yeah, we talk Selma, Ferguson, and Eric Garner. It's Comedy Central's worst nightmare. Brother finally gets a show on late night TV. Yeah. But of course, he's got to work on Martin Luther King Day. Let's do this.
Larry Wilmore, welcome back to Fresh Air and congratulations on your new show. So,
thank you.
Talk to us a little bit about thinking through what kind of show you really wanted to host. You had a half hour to work with. What are some of the ideas you abandoned, and what's the format you came up with?
Well, it's pretty much the way we first talked about it, a show where there would be both a panel segment with discussion and a comedy segment in the beginning. The only thing that was... took some talking through, and the show is still evolving, you know, as we're on the air right now, is what we call the third act. And that's the part where we do this, like, keeping it 100 place. And John and I talking about that, we wanted to do something that was both comic in that third act, but was also felt like a resolution to what we were doing at the same time. So that was a bit of a challenge, trying to figure out what that is. And that's still going to continue to evolve and be different types of things.
Well, you often start with, you know, an opening comic monologue. Let's hear the one from Martin Luther King Day, which was your first broadcast.
God, thank you. Thank you very much. Calm down. Thank you. I have to say, man, I am so excited to be here. This is so exciting. I mean, I feel like there's so much to talk about, you know? Oh, man, especially if I had the show a year ago. Man, all of the good, bad race stuff happened already. Seriously, there's none left. We're done. Happy MLK Day, everybody.
That's really funny, the idea that you wish you'd done the show a year ago because all the good, bad race stuff happened
all
already.
All the good, bad race stuff is done.
How did you come up with that?
Well, it was as we were developing the show, we were like, man, if we were on right now, we could cover this. Like every month that went by, it seemed like
something terrible was happening.
I know. It's the irony of doing this type of work, you know, as things go on in the world, you realize it's also fodder for your show. You know, it's one of the horrible ironies of doing this type of thing.
The centerpiece of your show is panel discussions, and on those panels are like politicians, pundits, comics, people who've lived the subject that you're talking about. It's a real mix.
Mm-hmm.
So why did you want to do panels as the centerpiece instead of, say, something more along the lines of The Daily Show or The Colbert Report, where either it's like, you know, fake news, so to speak, satirical news, or you're in persona as somebody?
Well, when you're doing a show like this, you have to figure out exactly what your show is about, right? And The Daily Show, at its core, is the answer to the nightly news, you know. And The Colbert Show, at its core, was kind of an answer to what you would call opinion news, you know, your Bill O'Reilly, that sort of thing. So we had to figure out who was our cousin in that. And for me, it was kind of like Meet the Press or George Stephanopoulos, you know, This Week, that sort of show. And at the heart of that show, the show was really about a conversation. So in the DNA of the show, it has to have that feeling and it has to have that mission. And that's why the panel part of it is so important, because it's both who our cousin, you know, our doppelganger in the real world of news, and it's what the mission statement of the show is to have a conversation about something.
You end the show with a segment called Keeping It 100. I will confess I didn't know the expression until
I am shocked,
your show.
Terry, that you would know that you would not know such an expression.
So explain the expression and what the segment of the show is.
Okay, so keeping it 100 means keeping it 100% real. And it comes from the expression called keeping it real, which means you are being completely honest. But it's kind of a fun term that's been around for a while. And I've used it in comedy for a little bit. And, you know, it's funny. I thought it would be an interesting way to ask a question. And that's pretty much how it came about. What was interesting, the actual etymology of it was, we didn't have that. We had like two test shows in front of an audience and two not in front of an audience. So we had very little time to figure out what our show was, because Colbert left. They had to break down that set, and then we moved in and they were building our set, right? So we had very little time. And we were trying to figure out what that third act was and how we were going to comically finish our conversation. And I had like I was up to like 4:30 in the morning the night before our last show, just trying to think of it. And that just kind of came to me. I was thinking about, well, what is our show? And I thought, at the heart, our show is about keeping it real, keeping it 100% real. And that's where I came up with the idea.
Well, I love the segment because you get to ask questions that are maybe a little bit indiscreet, that maybe go like a little bit further than
yes.
most people would be comfortable going. And then if the person answers in an honest way, you give them a little keeping it 100 button or
sticker.
Yes. Yeah. And
if they don't,
you throw tea bags at them because the answer is weak tea. So let's hear an example of this. And you were comparing what you do to being like the Comedy Central version, your version of, say, the Sunday morning shows like Meet the Press.
Mm-hmm.
This is a question asked of Cory Booker, who's now a senator from New Jersey, former mayor of mm-hmm. Newark. This question is asked to, like, all the politicians. And let's see how you handle it.
Okay, you ready? Got to keep it 100.
Bring it.
Do you want to be president?
No.
Audience? I got some weak tea for you.
Let me just say this. And everybody, we all, especially in politics, we are far more too concerned with position than purpose.
You get all the weak tea.
I'm just trying to keep it real.
Yes, the answer is yes.
I love that because it makes me think there are so many times I wish I could throw tea bags.
Sure. Yes, exactly. It's our own kind of tea party, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that must be so gratifying when somebody gives you an answer that you really think isn't honest or that is totally evasive, to actually throw tea bags at them.
Yes, it's fun because people are used to speaking in a very guarded way, you know.
Especially politicians.
Exactly. Politicians always say what they mean, but they never mean what they say, you know. So their words are always chosen so carefully. So it's fun to break that down. You know, when he started to go into that flowery explanation, it's like, no. We're not that type of show. You don't get a flowery explanation of why you don't want to answer the question, because that's what it is. The flowery explanation is you're explaining why you don't want to answer the question.
So how has hosting a nightly show 4 days a week changed your life, if you still have one, outside of your job?
The second part of your premise is correct. You really do not have a life. That's the thing they really don't tell you when you sign up for these types of things, you know, is that you are pretty much busy all day and you're pretty tired at night and you go home and you have tons of homework all the time, which for me, that part of it isn't too bad because I always am interested in news and that sort of thing. But my mornings are spent, you know, seeing what's going on, and my evenings are spent doing research for the next day. So it's pretty full. There's very little time on the weekends even.
You've been off this week. The show was dark this week's, well, since last Thursday, really, The Nightly Show and The Daily Show. So what have you been doing this week working on the show?
I've been away from the show for a little bit. I hosted the Writers Guild East Awards on Saturday night, and that was a lot of fun. And then I shot home to Los Angeles real quick Sunday and Monday, saw my kids and some of my brothers and sisters, parents and everything for a quick trip. I had a meeting at my daughter's school, and one of those college counseling things. You still got to do all the dad stuff. And just got back last night, and I'm heading to the office after we speak and start preparing on next week's shows and all kinds of little odds and ends types of things.
So your kids are young adults now?
Yes, my son is in his last year in high school. He's about to go off to college, and my daughter is a junior in high school.
Gosh, and you have to live on a different coast from them to host the show.
I know, it's insane. But at least they're older now, which is good. It would have been, I don't think I could have done it like this when they were younger. At this point, they're like, great, Dad, go for it. You know, we're on your side out here.
So you've done a lot of TV. Let's talk a little bit about your life in TV, which started
sure.
with Rick Dees' show. And Rick Dees was like a countdown top 40 DJ, right? Who also had mm-hmm. the hit Disco Duck in the mid-70s.
That's right. Thanks for bringing that up.
You're welcome. So what was the show and what was your contribution?
That was my first foray into television writing. I was mainly a stand-up comic and an actor at the time. That's how I started my career as a performer. I found it very challenging to, you know, to go on auditions and for the type of act that I had to get seen in Hollywood at the time. I felt a little frustrated, and I felt going into writing and producing might give me, a better chance to control my own career rather than be at the whims of Hollywood finding me and that sort of thing. And Rick Dees was my first TV writing job. I just wanted to break into, you know, that side of the business. A friend of mine was writing on the show, and they had a spot open. And, it's one of those entry-level type jobs. You don't know what you're doing yet. Most of your time is spent writing jokes for the host and writing sketches. But I only did that for about 6 months, and then I got hired on Living Color. And that really was my boot camp of comedy writing, was working on Living Color.
Let's talk a little bit about your life. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Pomona, California, suburb of Los Angeles, 30 miles east of Los Angeles.
I remember you telling me the last time we spoke that you went to mm-hmm. a Catholic school where I think you were one of like two black students. Was that a high school or?
That was my high school. I went to public school up until about the fourth grade. And I think starting in fifth grade, I went to the Catholic school through high school. Sacred Heart School in Pomona in grade school, and then Damien High School in La Verne, California. And Damien was an all-boys school. And that in that school, me and my friend Rick, we were the only blacks in our class. And, of course, we both played on the basketball team, of course.
What did religion mean in your life or your family's life?
It was really important to me. I thought about being a priest at one point, to be honest with you, when I was really young. And then I heard about the whole no sex thing, and I was like, I don't think that's going to work out. But I had always thought about some kind of life of service, I just felt like it just wasn't for me, ultimately. And I left the church for a while. I was agnostic for a long time, struggled with that, and I went to a Protestant church for a while and did the whole getting saved and all that. And then when I got married, my wife was a very devout Catholic. And I thought, well, you know, this is as good as anything. I think I evolved into a deist, to be honest with you. It's kind of my view on God and religion these days.
When you say deist, what do you mean?
I believe in God, but I just accept the fact that there are many different ways for people to reach God. So I don't believe that one religion has the necessarily the advantage over another in that search for God and for meaning in life. So that's kind of where I stand on it now. And I'm very, you know, for us to raise our kids, I'm actually, my wife and I are going through a divorce right now.
Oh, so I'm sorry. Yeah.
Oh, that's okay. I just want to say that in case people are getting the impression that that's going on. But we raised our kids, as Catholic because I knew how important it was for her, and it was important for me, too. And I thought, let's give our kids a nice foundation of something, and then they can choose what they want to do later. Because I think it's good to have a nice foundation in it. And if they want to leave or if they want to do whatever, I think, you know, at least they have something to start with.
Oh, I'm just thinking your life is complicated now, going through a divorce and starting a new show. That's a lot.
It was quite a year, Terry, I'll tell you, because it was tough when people would say, aren't you so excited about the new show? And I couldn't really say, well, yes, but I'm going through a divorce right now, too. So it's a swirl. This year has been a swirl of emotions because, you know, we were married for 20 years. It was a long time. But it's an amicable one. We're good friends and everything. So it's something we've been going through a long time, that kind of thing. So,
your parents divorced when mm-hmm. you were in high school or junior high school?
No, I was a lot younger. I was about 8 or 9, I think.
Oh, okay. And mm-hmm. and your father, after the divorce, left his career as a parole officer. He went to med school, and I assume he actually became a doctor.
Yeah, that was years later. He did that when I was in college, in my later in high school and college. But my parents split when I was a lot younger.
Mm-hmm. What message did it send to you that your father could change careers in his 40s?
It was very inspirational, actually, because I was trying to struggle with what to do in my life at that point. You know, I had always been a good student in coming up, although my last 2 years in high school were very difficult for me emotionally. There was just a lot going on. And I think I abandoned my academic career. And I kind of regretted that because I was a very good student. But I think it was too much for me emotionally to handle in my life at that time. And I kind of escaped into, I think, theater and performing. Also, when you talked about speech, those types of things. And I did a lot of escaping in those last 2 years in high school. And by the time I got into college, I was very concerned about what I was going to do. And when I saw my father do that, it gave me the confidence to just pursue what I wanted to do. Because I thought, look, at 40, I could still turn around and go back to school if my father's doing that. So ironically, it gave me confidence to do it. But I think one of the big turning points, one summer I sold books door to door. And I went into all these people's houses. This is when I was still in college. And I met so many people who were unhappy in their lives. I could just see it, you know, with their kids and everything. And I thought, Larry, do something that's going to make you happy at the end of the day. It was actually a very inspirational thing for me to do that. That was a big turning point.
What kind of books were you selling door to door? Encyclopedias?
It was like those. This was back in the days, once again, pre-internet, like those big. This was like a big encyclopedia thing. It was called the Volume Library, I remember. And then there were some kids' books, too. And you go to a different part of the country to sell books. So you spend a whole summer. I spent a whole summer in New England just going door to door selling books.
That's weird.
I know.
Did people ask for you to come, or you just knock on doors in the neighborhood?
You know, I don't know why I did it, but it was one of the biggest turning points in my life. And something drew me to it. I think I wanted to get away and just do something different one summer. I think somebody at school told me they were doing it. I thought, that sounds like a good adventure. And it was life-changing in a lot of different ways. It really was.
How did you figure out you wanted to go into comedy?
You know what? There were two parts to that. One, I always liked making people laugh. My brother and I did that growing up. But I didn't know if I could do that as for a living. And so the decision to do that came out of me realizing I may as well just do it. That was when I was in college. I remember sneaking into the Comedy Store when I was underage. And I remember seeing, like, Richard Pryor trying out material on stage, seeing David Letterman emceeing in there. And just thinking, man, there's no way I could do this. These people are just too good. And just dreaming about it back in those days and wanting to do it, but not knowing if it was something that I could do.
So this might be way too personal, so just tell me, because you don't have to talk about this. You have a collection of satirical essays kind of in different persona. That came out in, I think it was 2009, called I'd Rather We Got Casinos and Other Black Thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's dedicated to your nephew, Timmy, and you write, Whose Laugh Will Never Be Forgotten. May I ask what happened to your nephew?
Yes. My nephew was 22, and he was he just happened to be in the wrong place, and he was shot and killed. And it was devastating to our family. It still is. We'll never forget him. He was this really special kid. And that happened while I was trying to write the book, and it was very difficult to write it at the time. But ultimately, I used that as inspiration to finish it. I ended up writing it, I think, in 6 weeks, and it took me about 8 months to get to that point where I could actually do it. So it was very difficult.
Was anybody ever prosecuted for it?
Nope.
No one knows who did it? Was it a no-snitch kind of thing?
I think it was more of a no-snitch type of thing, because I think people might have known who did it. He was at a friend's house. They were looking for the friend of the house he was at, and he just happened to be there, and some guys came in, and I think they both started running, and they shot him in the back of the head.
It's really horrible. I'm very sorry.
No, I'll never forget that morning. It's something you just don't forget. But he was a good kid. So when I talk about violence in the community and those type of things, I do have a firsthand account of it also. I know how devastating it can be to families. It's horrible.
Are you, glad is the word wrong word here, but is it a good thing for you that you have a comedy vehicle now in which you can talk about issues? You can address violence. Mm-hmm. You can address fatherhood. You can address, like, the things that are central to who we are as individuals and as a society, and also be a comic at the same time. You can bring those two parts of your life and your mm-hmm. concerns and of reality together.
I think I'm very fortunate to be in this position. I absolutely love that I can do that. It really is the ultimate type of job for me, because I have both of those sides to me. As you know from talking with me, I'm not just a comic who's on stage all the time. I can be very thoughtful about these things, but I can be very silly at the same time. We could have a completely different interview right now. But I like the fact that, look, there are a lot of issues. Look at ISIS. That is a force. I don't even know how to categorize a group like ISIS and the type of inhumane things that are going on. And I think sometimes we need to talk about those things with sobriety, and sometimes we do need humor. I think we need a combination of the two. And I feel very fortunate that I'm one of the people that can do that, because I do look at the world from both of those standpoints, with a tremendous amount of both of those.
Larry Wilmore is host of The Nightly Show, Comedy Central's new program that follows The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Look around your house and notice all the electronic devices and appliances that help us communicate, prepare food, stay in shape, and keep us entertained. If Silicon Valley technologists are right, nearly every gadget you see will soon come with a little computer inside that can communicate with your smartphone and the wider world. They call it the Internet of Things and say it promises to revolutionize the way we interact with our homes. But does it really make sense to buy a coffee maker with a microprocessor and Wi-Fi built in? Fresh Air tech correspondent Alexis Madrigal decided to find out.
My coffee maker is texting me again. It's scheduled to make coffee tomorrow, the message says, but I need to refill its water tank. Welcome to the future. The Mr. Coffee Smart Optimal Brew coffee maker with Wemo, yes, that is its official name, is just one of many household appliances that's being remade to connect to the internet and take care of itself. There are thermostats, smoke alarms, washing machines, and even $1,000 Bluetooth-connected toilets. A Google subsidiary, Nest, which makes smart appliances, likes to talk about turning unloved products into simple, beautiful, thoughtful things. And the company's chief, Tony Fadell, has predicted that in 10 years, everything will have data in it. That's not difficult to imagine anymore. Computers are cheap and tiny, wireless internet is nearly everywhere, so technologists are looking to implant some computing power in nearly everything. I will admit, this can feel silly. I mean, who needs a coffee machine that texts them? Is that really necessary? Clearly, it's not. For years, I've used a simple French press. It does not have sensors, nor does it connect through my wireless network to nag me about its needs. All my simple French press does is make delicious coffee that's a bit better than my super smart Wi-Fi-enabled drip maker can manage. And yet, who does not want to hit the brew coffee button from bed? I at least wanted to know what that felt like, and it felt good. And even if they are silly now, these intelligent appliances are going to change the way our homes work. Because they have sensors built in, they'll be able to tell us when there are problems. Our homes will soon be like our cars, which can tell us when their tires are flat, the coolant is low, or you've left the door ajar. Just like the coffee maker told me about the water level, when the connected thermostat we installed in our home began to have trouble accessing the internet, its app on my phone informed me that the little device hadn't been logging in. And with all these gizmos and widgets becoming tiny computers, we're going to need to count on them to be smart enough to help us figure out this IT mess. No one wants the air conditioner offline as often as the printer. But diagnostics are only one part of what data will do for these household objects. The other thing is that tracking data at least offers the opportunity to optimize a routine. So imagine that a future coffee maker might notice that I make coffee at 6 a.m. but don't pour it until 6:45. It might spot that trend and offer to push back the brew time so that the coffee's fresher. Already, some thermostats automatically make just these sorts of decisions about heating and cooling. The ultimate smart home vision is a home that basically runs itself. The egg carton tells the fridge it's empty, which puts eggs into the list for a shopping app, which then delivers those things to your door. Meanwhile, the smart front door lock knows the delivery person is coming and opens itself automatically when they arrive. All the little things that need to happen for a home to run smoothly will be assigned to your own personal army of domestic bots connecting through apps to on-demand services. But boy, are we not there yet. The real world is a hard place for little computers to operate in. Sure, I can control my Nest thermostat from bed, but because of the way our heating system was set up in the 1990s, new wires needed to be run to power it. That required getting an electrician to visit our house and a couple fun hours in the dank basement. And the coffee maker, for its part, is not a magical all-in-one machine that grinds and brews coffee with self-replacing filters. It still requires me to take a bunch of steps from buying consumable materials to cleaning and only automates the final one, the brewing process, which is actually the easiest part. At this point, the reason to use smart appliances is not that they are better than standard machines at a given job, but that they make everyone's favorite device, the smartphone, more fun and powerful. Internet-connected things make your phone feel like a controller for the world. And if the utility each appliance adds is small, the collective convenience of all those things gathered into little rows of icons is startling. From bed, in 10 taps, I can make coffee, turn up the heat, call a car, turn on my stereo, and record a television show with my cable box. All I have to do is push a button on a screen, and something happens out there in the physical world. And that action, funny as it might be in the current forms of internet-connected toilets and Wi-Fi-enabled coffee makers, really is the future.
Alexis Madrigal is a visiting scholar at Berkeley Center for Science, Technology, Medicine, and Society, and is the Silicon Valley Bureau Chief for the Fusion Cable and Digital Network. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. When my guest, journalist Bill Gifford, turned 40, his friends gave him a cake shaped as a tombstone with the words, "My youth, rest in peace," on it. As he reflected on his creeping memory lapses and the weight he'd gained, Gifford got interested in the timeless quest to turn back the aging clock, or at least slow it down. The result is his book, Spring Chicken, which explores everything from some wacky pseudo-cures for aging you'll soon hear about to fascinating research that points to causes of aging at the cellular level. And there are some interesting phenomena in the natural world, like an animal that lives long, shows no increase in mortality with age, never gets cancer, and never experiences menopause. Bill Gifford is a contributing editor for Outside Magazine and has written on science, health, and fitness for Wired, Men's Journal, The New Republic, and other publications. He's the author of a previous book, Ledyard, In Search of the First American Explorer. Well, Bill Gifford, welcome to Fresh Air. You have some great stories in here about things people have done to fight the aging process. One of them involves a British professor, Charles Edward Brown Sequard, if I have the name right.
Sequard.
Sequard, yep. Okay. What was the treatment he came up with in the late 19th century?
Right. So he was one of the great scientists of the 19th century. He's regarded as the founder of endocrinology, the study of glands. And when he got to be about 70 years old, he wasn't feeling so hot, and he started to wonder why. And he thought that the answer had to do with something produced in the gonads. So he mixed up a little mixture of crushed up dog testicles, testicular blood, and semen, mixed it all up, and injected himself with it for a period of about 3 weeks. And then in 1889, he gave a triumphant address to the Society of Biology in Paris, describing this experiment and how it had miraculously rejuvenated him, an old man. You know, he could work through the night now. He could lift much more weight. He could urinate farther. All these fantastic things. And people were horrified.
Well, as they well might be. I mean, distance urination might not be the first goal in medicine. Yeah. Did he live long?
Well, he was already 70 or 71, and he lived about another 5 years. So he did pretty well for the 19th century. But whether the treatment extended his lifespan, difficult to say. I mean, they now think it was pretty much of a placebo effect.
Did anybody try it after him?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It became a cultural sensation, and people were mail-ordering. It was called the Sequard Elixir. And all kinds of quacks set up mail order businesses where you could get 10 syringes for $2.50. There were songs written about it. It was written up in all the papers. People went crazy. And he never made a dime off it. So,
do you happen to know any of the songs for this elixir?
One of them went, here's a verse. It said, "The latest sensation's the Sequard elixir that's making young kids of the withered and gray. There'll be no more pills or big doctor bills or planting of people in churchyard clay."
Okay. Now, he did inspire some other treatments after that, right?
Well, in a way, Sequard's elixir was kind of a precursor of the testosterone replacement and estrogen replacement therapies that are extremely popular right now. So, you know, he was on to something.
And there was this guy, John Brinkley, who had a rather more extreme version
right,
of this.
So,
tell us about him.
Right. In between the elixir and the testosterone, there was an unfortunate intermediate step where a salesman named John Brinkley down in Texas began implanting goat testicles in worn-out middle-aged men. And he did similar surgeries in women. And obviously, not a good idea. And many people died on his operating table, but he became fabulously wealthy. He was one of the richest men in the pre-Depression era. He actually had a radio station down there. He was just across the border in Mexico because they kicked him out of the country. But he had this hugely powerful radio station that broadcast some of the early country music stars.
Yeah, border radio was a phenomenon.
Border radio.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot
he
of people
it.
Cross the border and then broadcast all kinds of stuff that would be, well, questionable if not illegal in the States.
And paid for by quack testicle implants.
Let's talk about exercise in terms of longevity. You describe meeting some amazing athletes that are in their 60s and 70s. Tell us about these folks.
Right. I went to the National Senior Games in Cleveland in 2013. And that's like a sort of Olympics for older people. And I didn't really know what to expect, but I was blown away. I saw 85-year-olds sprinting down the track in the 100-meter dash, just going as hard as they could and pretty fast. And, you know, doing the pole vault. I saw an old, you know, I don't want to say old. She wasn't old, but she was 89. This woman throwing heaving a javelin a pretty healthy distance, you know. And so these people were clearly extraordinary. And so I started looking at the science behind what they did and why, you know, why could they do this? Why could they still sprint and long jump at their age? I mean, the idea of doing a long jump makes my knees throb. And basically I found that exercise is this incredibly, apart from being quote-unquote good for you, right, it's this incredibly potent, it's almost like a drug. It's almost like a medicine itself.
And it works how? How is it a medicine? Yeah.
Well, in a variety of ways. They've found that, you know, when you're, just as your fat is this endocrine organ, muscle works the same way. So when you're exercising, your muscles are sending out signals to other parts of your body that basically say, hey, you know, we might be chasing a woolly mammoth or something, so you guys better be performing at your best, right? And it also, they've also found that it stops the aging of your mitochondria, the little power plants in your cells, and it reverses the patterns of gene expression that are associated with aging. So it sort of switches your gene expression back to a younger profile. It's very powerful. I mean, if you could put exercise in a pill, you'd make $1 zillion.
And does it need to be, I mean, rigorous exercise as we get older? I mean, do I need to be pole vaulting, or is walking okay?
It has to be pole vaulting.
Oh, damn.
No, not really. I mean, anything really is better than nothing. Basically, we evolved to move around, to run, to walk, to use our bodies, and not to just sit around the way most of us do for most of the day. So there's kind of an idea of, like, use it or lose it. And that's really kind of programmed into our biology. The more you use your muscles, the more you're walking around, the more you're going to hang on to your muscle as you get older. And that's really important because, you know, muscle wasting with age is the second leading cause of admission to nursing homes after Alzheimer's disease. So these athletes, you know, I'm sure their kids think they're crazy for pole vaulting. Like, Mom, why do you got to do that? But they're going to stay in a better functional health for much longer than they would otherwise.
Yeah, I forget who it was in the book that says sitting is the new smoking in terms of harm to your health.
And it's really true. I mean, public health experts are beginning to view inactivity itself as, if not a disease, as a serious risk factor. And there was a study in The Lancet in 2013 that found that inactivity was responsible for more than 5.3 million premature deaths every year. So you're talking about heart disease, but also things like colon cancer.
You write about naked mole rats. Tell us about them.
Right. So that is the most bizarre and weirdly cute animal I think I've ever encountered in my life. They're little critters. They live underground. They're from Africa. And they live in a kind of a colony. And they're this – I held one in my hand. She was the size of about a mouse, between a mouse and a rat. And she was 28 years old, whereas a mouse lives to about 2 years old. So this was like a, you know, in human terms, a 600-year-old person, woman, and she was pregnant. Wow. So they have these tremendously long lifespans. They have huge amounts of oxidative stress in their bodies, and it does not affect them at all.
What does
Somehow
that mean?
They can survive this.
What does that mean, oxidative stress?
Well, so that's a chemical thing. You know, you hear about antioxidants and free radicals. Free radicals are like unpaired oxygen molecules, and they rampage around, and they're very reactive, and they cause all kinds of chemical damage. And it used to be thought that this drove the aging process. This was the first real theory of aging, oxidative stress. And it's since, over the decades, it's been sort of discredited, or it's faded away because of things like the naked mole rat, which can survive to a very, very old age with huge amounts of oxidative stress.
And what's remarkable about them, if I have this right, I mean, the females do not get menopause. They continue to reproduce into old age. They don't get cancer, even if you smear them with a carcinogen. It's like suntan.
Right. They paint them with toxic chemicals, and they're just fine. So I think it goes down to the cellular level again. They have these mechanisms in their cells that just – it's like a repair mechanism, right? So they survive a lot more damage, and they live a lot longer.
Is there anything we can learn from their cellular mechanics and structures that will help us?
Well, they recently sequenced the mole rat genome, so they're looking pretty hard for whatever that might be. On the other hand, it might just be an anomaly. It might just be one weird critter. We don't know. But the point is that nature knows how to let animals live a very long time, but it all has to do with back to this age of reproduction thing. There's no point in creating a mouse that's going to live for 20 years when your typical mouse lives for about 6 months before it gets eaten.
And the mole rats really have no predators where they are?
No, they live underground. It's dark. It's safe. There's nobody else down there.
You describe an operation that people use in research called parabiosis. Let's explain what that is, and then and we'll go into some interesting things we've learned about it. What is it?
Right. So this dates from the testicular injection era of science, but there was another enterprising French scientist who sewed two rats together as like Siamese twins to see what would happen. So about 100 years later, somebody thought of using this to study aging, and you'd sew an older animal to a younger animal and see what happened.
So the idea is you make an incision, say, in the left side of one animal and then on the right side of the other, and then what?
They're kind of joined at the elbows and in the torso.
And then what? Do their kind of blood vessels align? Do they start sharing organs or what?
Right. Their circulatory systems will kind of intertwine. And within a few weeks, they'll be sharing the same blood, essentially. And so what happens is the older animal will be sort of miraculously rejuvenated in multiple tissues. So like muscles will be in better shape. Heart, it reverses the aging of hearts.
This is in the case where an older animal is joined with a young animal.
Yeah, yeah. And even neurons. I mean, it restores the connectivity of neurons, which is something that we lose and lose and lose and lose with age.
Yeah, this was fascinating.
It was quite phenomenal.
It was fascinating. There were these mice that, I forget, they had forgotten something that they were supposed to do about finding some board so that they don't get wet.
And right. They put them in a water maze, and the older ones would get lost and fumble around, you know, make all these mistakes, and it was sad. And then they were injected with young blood plasma, and they were like, boom, they solved the maze quickly.
Wow. If we extrapolate that to humans, if someone's aging and losing, you know, brain function or getting forgetful, whatever, younger blood in the circulatory system could reverse it?
Right. Well, there's clearly some factors or several factors in young blood that are missing when we get older. So if you can restore them, you can go back to sort of a more youthful state. And it's particularly interesting and exciting in the area of Alzheimer's, which, you know, there's no really good treatment for Alzheimer's yet. So they're hopeful. There's a team at Harvard that's found one of these factors, something called GDF11, and there's various others. And they're kind of hopeful that this will yield some sort of treatment for Alzheimer's and then maybe even for heart failure.
So the idea would be to identify that factor rather than just doing blood transfusions.
No, you don't want to be doing blood transfusions from your interns. You know, you want to find what the protein is or the factor is and then make that and somehow turn that into some sort of medication.
In the book, you describe a lot of things, some of which are really kooky and some of which are interesting but kind of a long way off from any practical implementation. But in the appendix, you list some things that you might want to try that might just work. You want to give us a few?
Well, I'm an English major, so nobody should try anything based on my say-so. No, I'm not advising anybody to do anything. But there are a few medications that are in common use right now that have shown promise and may actually delay aging and diseases of aging. So one of them is a diabetes drug called metformin. It's been around for decades. Millions of people take it. They did a study that found that diabetics on metformin were actually living longer than non-diabetics who were matched in every way. So normally diabetes takes 5 to 7 years off your life, but the diabetics on metformin seem to be living longer. So that was interesting.
And do we know why, how it works?
Metformin's been around for decades, and they still pretty much don't know how it works, just that it does work. And then there's another one called rapamycin, which is it's a transplant drug. It was actually found in the soil of Easter Island, and they found that that extends the lifespan of mice. It turns out that this weird microbe found in the dirt of this remote island sort of unlocks one of the key metabolic pathways in all our cells. So that's a very promising medication also.
Did doing this reporting change your own lifestyle in any ways that have lasted?
I knew I was going to get this
question. Moment of truth.
Actually, yeah, it did. You know, I spent several years hanging around with these scientists and visiting them in their labs, and they would do things like, you know, I'd push the elevator button and they'd look at me like, what? We're taking the stairs. You know, they would go running at lunchtime. They would almost never eat dessert. And so I started looking at their lifestyle and going, they think they know something. So I, even though I was, you know, neck deep in writing this book, I made it a point to get out and try and exercise every single day, you know, on my bike. I'm a big bike rider, or go running, or, you know, in the winter, go skiing or skating or whatever. And also being more conscious of what I eat. You know, I at a certain point, I quit eating hamburgers, French fries, any kind of fast food, and just trying to, you know, eat a diet based on fresh food, less processed food, all that kind of stuff that Suzanne Summers talks about.
And she's right. And you've stayed with it pretty much.
Yeah, you know, I lost 10 pounds. I feel good. I'm pretty good shape. I have a group of guys I go out mountain biking with every week, and got to stay in shape for that.
Okay. Well, Bill Gifford, it's been interesting. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Bill Gifford is the author of the new book, Spring Chicken, Stay Young Forever or Die Trying. You'll find a longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.